Welcome to the Playfair Library for this Gifford lecture. I'm Alison Elliott, I'm on the Gifford Committee and I'm an Honorary Fellow at New College. And I'm delighted to welcome our distinguished speaker, Professor Welker, Professor at the University of Heidelberg, as he continues his Gifford series on the theme In God's Image, Anthropology. He started out with an introductory lecture, and then he outlined the multimodal and multipolar perspectives that he has on the spirit. That was followed by Call to Justice and Call to Freedom. And this evening, we hear the fifth of his six lectures, which is entitled Call to Truth. An understanding of the liberating potential inhering in the search for truth requires that we consider not only its cognitive and ethical dimensions, but also its religious manifestations. The latter necessitates a critical look at distortions such as the influence, metaphysical and subjectivist conceptions of God that are largely responsible for people having turned away from faith. Critiques of religion by Marx, Nietzsche and Bonhoeffer also disclose how such distortions promote reductionist conceptions of human beings. So that's an outline of the lecture tonight. Please note that the lecture and the questions this evening are being recorded and the video will shortly be available online on the University's Gifford Lectures web pages. And we should also note, if you haven't noted already, the correction. Some of the publicity has said that the next lecture will be on Thursday the 6th of November, whereas Thursday is the 7th of November. So anyway, it's Thursday. But I now have great pleasure in handing over to Professor Michael Welker.
Thank you very much indeed. Call to truth. Today's lecture inquires first concerning how one is to understand the multimodal spirit of truth, the activities of which extend from the familiar notion of accuracy or correctness to a worldwide network of research and teaching among university scientists and scholars, with all the operations attaching to the search for truth and the testing of resulting truth claims. Truth claims are measured and tested against standards of accuracy, certainty, consensus, coherence, and so on. At the same time, organized, methodologically rigorous, innovative research is initiated with the goal of disclosing and acquiring new knowledge commensurate with these standards. Part two of the lecture describes such a search for truth as conducted by a group of international and interdisciplinary scientists and scholars seeking to expand their approaches to anthropology and whose findings can acquire relevance for an anthropology shaped from the perspectives of natural theology. Part three then describes concepts of God within natural theology that might support such anthropological findings. What emerges is that claims to universal validity asserted by theological doctrines of God, not tied to specific religious traditions, prove untenable. And further, that the insights and assertions of natural theology itself must be subjected to modern critiques of religion. Part three also opens discussions whether the assertion from the theology of revelation that God is spirit and seeks to be worshipped in spirit and truth can be rendered as an assertion commensurate with natural theology. Viewed in a general and formal sense, the spirit, as the young Hegel put it, is an active power that generates and influences relationships through synthesis and differentiation. Very abstract, very general. Attempts to deal meaningfully with this complex power have tended to concentrate on the spirit's manifestation in bipolar constellations. For example, in subject and object, cognition an object of cognition, I and thou, person and fellow human person, self and other, self and world, God and human being, and so on and so on. Such bipolar constellations have served to facilitate an access to truth, in which truth is understood as the coincidence of thinking and of object, or of subjective assertions and facts of the objective world or similar relationships. Bipolar, very efficient for fast communication and for simple testing of truth claims. The following discussion will assess bipolar constellations as manifestations of the multimodal spirit, while simultaneously objecting when such manifestations are taken as absolute. So I want to treasure these bipolar modes of thinking. I do not want to push them away with a vague multiplicity of dimensions, but I want to warn against absolutizing these forms. So my first part, truth within the arc, extending from accuracy to internationally organized scientific and scholarly researches for truth. As earlier in the lectures on freedom, allow me here too to commence with an elementary definition. The most rudimentary understanding of truth is simply accuracy, which is applicable to both judgments and actions. Is something just as it was conceived or asserted and as it was observed? Is the statement concerning it correct? Did a particular act genuinely proceed thus and not otherwise? Viewing something as accurate provides at least a preliminary element of security, both in judgment and in one's confidence of being able to provide knowledge capable of rational and intersubjective substantiation. The self-evident nature of our dealings with such assumptions of correctness in daily life, though also their occasionally swift collapse, should not mislead us into downplaying this elementary mode of multimodal truth and its ascertainment. So in all of my lectures, I want to offer you this multi-layer and then say, don't belittle the very modest forms. To take but one example, very important example. Michael Welker in Nehren outside Tübingen can be reached by telephone at 07473-6620. This information was correct, and the statement was true in the years prior to August 1987. Its accuracy and veracity could be ascertained by a glance at the telephone book, by inquiries among Michael Welker's acquaintances, and of course by dialing the number itself. Today, however, this statement is true only with qualifications. That is, Michael Welker could be reached in Nehren outside Tübingen by telephone until mid-1987 under the number 07 and so on. That statement was correct, and that the statement was correct is irrelevant today in its truth, as Hegel so eloquently expressed it, has become stale. So we have, in a way, worthless truths. Citing a dramatic dispute concerning truth, namely the famous case of Galileo, Alfred North Whitehead, in his Science in the Modern World, underscored how important it is to qualify statements that make truth claims. I give you a longer quote. Quote I like very much. Galileo said that the earth moves and that the sun is fixed. The Inquisition said that the earth is fixed and the sun moves. And Newtonian astronomers, adopting an absolute theory of space, said that both the sun and the earth move. But now we say that any one of these statements is equally true, provided that you have fixed your sense of rest and motion in a way required by the statements adopted. At the day of Galileo's controversy with the Inquisition, Galileo's way of stating the facts was beyond question the fruitful procedure for the sake of scientific research. But in itself, it was not more true than the formulation of the Inquisition. But at that time, the modern concepts of relative motion were in nobody's mind, so that the statements were made in ignorance of the qualifications required for their more perfect truth. Yet this question of the motion of the Earth and the Sun expresses a real fact in the universe, and all sides had got hold of important truths concerning it. But with the knowledge of those times, the truths appeared to be inconsistent. The Inquisition supported the perspective of healthy human understanding, to which the German and also, as I learned, the English children's rhyme still applies even today. The sun rises in the east, turns south at midday's feast, in north it is never seen, in the west it sets serene. That is, the view supported the perspective of sensory certainty with its powerful truth claim. After all, anyone can see the sun rises in the east. From the modern perspective, of course, a certain element of irony attaches to the fact that it was the same inquisitors as representatives of Christian religion who, with their own truth claims, for example, faith in the resurrection, first presented enormous challenges to healthy human understanding and sensory certainty, and yet then appealed to this same healthy human understanding and sensory certainty to counter new scientific findings of astronomy. As is well known, the Church has still not entirely recovered from the loss of trust it incurred with that earlier decision. The case of Galileo throws considerable light on the limited capacity of sensory certainty in the search and defense of truth. For one cannot assert that, as a German colleague said, truth is accessible to human beings solely in the mode of certitude. One cannot assert that truth is accessible to us only to the extent we are fully aware and convinced of this truth in certainty. Such certitudinal orientation, or the linking of truth to certainty, remains problematic. For a great many acts performed within our conscious lives are sustained by knowledge of truth quite without the more or less explicit elimination of irritation and doubt that allegedly characterizes our sense of certainty. Human beings constantly live with trust not only in innumerable assumptions of accuracy, but also in numerous assumptions of accuracy supported by proven truth claims about which they themselves have in fact not personally established certainty. The extent to which such truth claims must be proven, of course, can vary widely, a situation in its own turn leading to disputes concerning their tenability. Such also applies to the consensus theory of truth, based on the coordination of a multiplicity of certainties, and to the coherence theory of truth, which views this compatible interrelation of knowledge and assertions to be a necessary condition for making truth claims. It is important to realize that no personal truth search, though also no scientifically supported truth search, is in a position, I quote John Polkinghorne, to claim that it achieves absolute certainty beyond the possibility of any further refinement or correction. Rather, its achievement will be gaining a degree of understanding which is sufficiently insightful in its explanatory character for the acceptance to be something to which is entirely rational to commit oneself. A wonderful quote of Sir John. In numerous dialogues between theology and the natural sciences, John Polkinghorne and I have posed the question of what exactly characterizes truth seeking communities in science and in religion. We have found that on the one hand, the search for truth seeks to solidify and stabilize certainties and to attain concurrence and a broad consensus as possible, as broad a consensus as possible, concerning those certainties. On the other hand, the search for truth seeks to attain and then expand the element of coherent understanding. Although these two operations, on focusing on consensus and the other on empirically, historically based coherence, often enough variously irritate each other. That same irritant contributes toward making the search for truth a productive process. So we mutually enhance our insights, and this is a little bit more elaborated than the Aristotelian model. Yeah? Here I am, the cognitive subject and the object, and here we have processes of the search for truth, correlating and mutually enhancing. The formally organized search for truth does enjoy several advantages. For example, by offering an enormous inventory of tested and refuted truth claims, and thus providing elements of truth that at least for the moment are verifiable. The inherent mutual correctives obtaining between specialists in a given field, along with the presence of severe sanctions, for example, damage to one's reputation as a result of certifying untenable truth claims, enable organized science and scholarship to offer an important defense system against error and deception in the various disciplines. And by virtue of its status as a training center for those interested in moving into responsible positions of leadership into society, it is also able to dispatch or mediate, as it were, its own ethos of truth and multimodal spirit of truth to all spheres of life. Its heart is found in the universities that throughout the world combine research and teaching, and through the granting of doctoral degrees train qualified individuals for conducting future research. Accuracy, certainty, consensus, coherence, commensurability, tested and proven truth knowledge claims, thus some of the criteria used in evaluating truth claims within the context of any search for truth. Yet, the spirit of truth that tests, evaluates, and ultimately confirms truth claims is but a single, albeit important, part of the organized system of science and scholarship. The ongoing stimulating pedagogical exchange with new generations of students, and the enthusiasm and competition within research operations themselves are sustained by the commitment to the search for truth for the sake of creative, expanded knowledge. The fact that attention is occasionally and quite justifiably drawn to pioneering innovations outside organized research institutions militates not at all against the sustaining value of an organized system of research, scholarship, and teaching. So, praise to the universities. An element of ethical significance is also attributed to the spirit of truth that radiates far beyond the sphere of science and scholarship out into society of large. The Berlin philosopher Volker Gerhardt considered it a danger to Western civilization that the current president of the United States of America consistently disregards truth in an effort to cultivate his own image, claiming to do so, moreover, for the sake of doing what is allegedly economically best for his country. Massive amounts of incorrect information and assertions are sent out into the world in the guise of truth. On April 29th to 19, the Washington Post had counted 10,000 cases of falseness and lies that had been disseminated since Trump took office in January 2017. The Toronto newspaper, being a little bit more merciful, counted only 5,000. But I think we would all agree even 1,000 would be devastating. Gerhard also observes, however, that as desperate as the situation indeed is, this presidential renunciation of truth has accomplished one good thing, namely bring to an end within a few weeks the dismissal of truth that for much too long had already been viewed as unsurpassably modern, or even already postmodern, whereas until the spring of that year, 2017, attributing any meaning at all to truth was considered a sign of unequivocal backwardness. There is now a rush to remove any and all doubts about the indispensability of truth, not only in the marches for science, but also in academic circles. Gerhard justifiably insists that people had, I quote him, and I agree, underestimated the moral significance of truth while overestimating its metaphysical status. And then, of course, sheer metaphysics, yeah, not too important. When the will to assert serious and resilient truth claims is abandoned, we lose our moorings in thinking, acting, and interacting. It is precisely, as Gerhard says, the relativity of the human experience of the world and the variety, contrariness, and even enduring irreconcilability of positions that must make us conscious that indeed nothing is more urgent now than to hold fast to truth. During the past few years, an international and interdisciplinary research project dedicated to an expanded understanding of certain aspects of anthropology in this sense has yielded findings that are both promising for science and scholarship and revealing for the human ethos. I come to my second part. Sorry. An interdisciplinary search for truth and its discovery of a differentiated natural theological anthropology. The dialogue science and religion was initially strongly shaped by philosophically interested theologians, religious scholars, and physicists. In his Gifford Lectures, 1898 to 91, Ian Barber described four models applicable to this dialogue, namely conflict, independence, dialogue, integration. Although these models were later refined and expanded, the fundamental bipolar constellation continued to assert itself even as the field of natural science expanded to include biology, neurology, psychology, and that of theology and philosophy to include historical and exegetical disciplines. We spent several exhausting years struggling with the dual physicalist and mentalist approach, and with the question of whether the two areas might be amalgamated into a single theoretical framework. One particularly well-received reaction to the question monist or dualist approach was, we need a dual aspect monism. Years of struggle. After several years of consultations and assessment of the broad spectrum of truth claims coming from the various scientific and scholarly disciplines, we concluded programmatically that, at least in our shared work in the field of anthropology, we needed a multidimensional approach. I myself initiated an international consultation extending over several years with colleagues from physics, biology, psychology, philosophy, religious studies, and systematic, ethical, historical, and biblical theology. Quite a field. The commitment to a multidimensional approach came to expression in the title Body, Soul, Spirit, The Complexity of the Human Person. So proudly I invited the colleagues under this title. I confess that the first meeting began with a severe shock for me as the organizer. For the analytical philosopher Andreas Kemmerling quickly assured I quickly issue the following noteworthy warning. Although you are intent on scrutinizing and possibly overcoming dualist approaches to anthropology, nonetheless, by concentrating on the complexity of the human person, you will fall into a bottomless pit. Kemmerling proceeded to explicate his fundamental skepticism over against precisely this approach. Philosophy and its neighboring disciplines, he explained, engage over 20 concepts of person that resist any clear organizing principle. How do you intend to impose order and clarity on these concepts? A person, for example, he said and wrote, is an individual capable of rationality, is responsible for what it does, has dignity, is not something but a someone, is free, is a unity of body and mind or soul, is an intelligent agent capable of happiness and misery, is an end in itself and an object of respect, is an entity to which both mental and physical properties can be ascribed, is capable of treating others as persons, is capable of verbal communication, is conscious and self-conscious, and so on. Amid this obvious derailment of our very point of departure, an unanticipated succor came from the field of New Testament studies. Gerd Theissen, Heidelberg colleague, New Testament, offered a contribution on Paul's understanding of the flesh and the body that both surprised and inspired us. He demonstrated that Paul's anthropology cannot be fully grasped or comprehended on the basis of the offensive dualism of flesh and spirit. Instead, what Paul is in fact offering is an ambitious anthropology with surprising syntheses and differentiations. The body, for example, cannot simply be identified with predatory flesh focused on self-preservation, but is instead the locus of various energies associated with soul and spirit. Hence, the locus of the polyphonous interaction between all the members and a source of multidimensional psychosomatic resonance. You can imagine that I, coming out of my work on the spirit and the multidimensionality of the spirit, had glowing eyes when I saw this clearly. By the way, of course, I knew many members and so, but this dramatic thing that you see, okay, flesh, predatory, self-sustaining, very important. Body, partly flesh, but partly also loaded. How she looks, how he smiles, how they walk. Yeah? And then this multidimensionality and so on, wonderful stuff. The oft-lamented sharp dualism between flesh and spirit in fact marks what for Paul is the extremely important distinction between finitude, flesh, and eternity, spirit. The fleshly and spiritual body, moreover, though also the fleshly and spiritual heart, an organ of emotional, cognitive, and volitional energy, along with the psychosomatic unity of the soul, emphasize various aspects of the differentiated totality of the human person. Paul's differentiation between reason and spirit and his non-bipolar understanding of conscience are also of considerable import here. The human conscience, for example, is not simply one's inner voice, but rather an entire forum of voices that both accuse and defend, and that must first pass through other human faculties before arriving to a certain degree of concentration and inner peace. Yeah. So our conscience is loaded with all sorts of educational experiences, father and mother neurosis, teacher neurosis, whatever. Yeah. And it's full of voices that excuse and accuse each other. And it takes quite some energy to bring it down to the simple notion of me and my inner voice. Paul is inspiringly gifted, Hellenistically trained, an educated Pharisee and citizen of Rome, and indeed of the world, multi-contextually oriented toward the needs of different church communities. He engages travel and epistolatory correspondence as communication media. And in doing so, offers a multifaceted anthropology that makes it possible to illuminate interrelations between the varied cognitive powers and experiential spheres. His approach also makes it possible to critique uncalcated anthropological dualisms, body-soul, body-spirit, and so on. Yet also brings to clearer expression anthropological entities such as soul and spirit that in many scholarly fields outside theology have long become obsolete. One very important point was that Paul differentiates between reason and spirit that great Aristotle uses. Although his anthropology is indeed tied to a theology of revelation, its fundamental insights can also be clearly explicated and applied to the level of natural theology. These same insights provide considerable impetus and direction for disclosing a multimodal understanding of the human spirit and, as already seen in my second lecture, for providing a solid basis on which to critique the bipolar intellectualist conception. Such an anthropological approach, commensurate with natural theology, can also be disclosed in other areas of the biblical tradition, similarly located within contexts of a theology of revelation. The Tübingen Old Testament scholar Bernd Janowski recently, a few weeks ago, published a comprehensive anthropology of the Old Testament, 800 pages, that takes its orientation from the various stages of human life and makes quite clear that the lives of people in ancient Israel were characterized by experiences of corporeality, the ethos of justice, and a consciousness of finitude. Janowski discloses a whole array of phenomena involving human faculties and social relationships that was determinative not only for biblical Israel, but also for vast stretches of the world of antiquity at large, and which is also quite capable of providing cognitive anthropological impulses for today's world. Not as strong as Paul, but still very illuminating. This particular mode of operation that focuses on a broad selection of culturally and religio-historical oriented disciplines and their claim of knowledge similarly provides a promising contribution to natural theology. I come to my third part, God as Spirit, translating a statement from the theology of revelation into a statement commensurate with natural theology. The first example, I quote Wolfhard Pannenberg in his Systematic Theology, the first example of the expression natural theology is found in Panaitios, the founder of Middle Stoicism. Panaitios used the term for the philosophical doctrine of God as distinct from the mythical theology of the poets on the one side, and on the other, the political theology of the cults which the states set up and supported. Wolfhard Pannenberg quite rightly notes that the philosophical doctrine of God is to be designated as natural because it corresponds to the nature of the divine itself, unfalsified by political interests related to the state cults or by the literary imaginings or lies, as was said, of the poets. A cogent enough explanation that does, however, beg the question of what exactly corresponds to the nature and truth of the divine itself. Because natural theology tries to speak about the question of religion and worldviews such that its statements are universally valid, many of its propagators have sought refuge in the conceptual world of speculative metaphysics. When speaking about God, they have adduced the absolute, the infinite, the eternal, the one and undivided, the highest being, and all sorts of ultimate ideas. to render such references valid or acceptable to all religions and cultures. These lofty abstractions, moreover, have been generally accompanied by considerable and quite resolute truth claims or truth assertions. Similar metaphysical references came to a deft expression in a presentation given by a philosopher, Heidelberg philosopher, in the Heidelberg Academy of Science and Humanities under the title God in Thinking, Why Philosophy Cannot Dispense with the Question of God. To the astonishment of many academy members, however, who thought theology ought to welcome such accommodating responsiveness from philosophy, not every reaction was positive. A jurist, for example, wondered what such speculative notions of God had to do with divine justice, and, indeed, whether notions of God that abstract from the admittedly difficult topic of God's justice were really referring to a God at all. A theologian similarly wondered whether metaphysical notions of God were not soteriologically empty, that is, whether they were not devoid of God's sustaining, saving, elevating activities. Considerable doubts persisted concerning whether speculative ideas contributed anything toward enabling natural theology to speak at all, as it claims, about the essence and nature of God. Tradition has been inclined to maneuver past the thorny problem created for theology by such ultimate metaphysical ideas concerning God by invoking a cosmogonic overlay, as it were, of the first, last, and highest being, to wit, by portraying God as the all-creating and all-determining primal force. But even this primitive form of understanding creation has become increasingly beset by questions and doubts. Forced as it is to constantly ignore the varied ambivalence of nature and natural life, and being unable to provide any persuasive response to the question of the efficaciousness of a just and beneficent God in a world so overly replete with inequitable distributed suffering. Critiques of religion, both outside and inside theological circles, have not surprisingly concentrated on this disastrous mix of speculative metaphysics and implausible cosmology. The most incisive forms of such criticism were developed in Germany during the 19th century period of early European modernity by Karl Marx and Friedrich Nietzsche, both of whom are still viewed as the classic authors of modern critique of religion. These two thinkers engaged critically not only with the Christian religion itself in its understanding of piety, but also with their own religio-critical and socio-critical philosophical predecessors. That is, they attacked not only illusory religious worldviews, but also religio-critical moralizing philosophies, and in Nietzsche's case, other fields in which scientific and moral truth claims were being made. This mode of operation enhanced the impact of their own critiques of religion, and because these critiques expanded into a more sweeping critique of worldviews and culture, they also possess relevance for natural theology that makes universal truth claims. The most astute representatives of 20th century German-speaking Christian theology, here I will mention only Karl Barth, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and Paul Tillich, took careful note of these broadly conceived critiques of religion, morality, and worldviews. They recognized that any Christian theology intent on avoiding not only religious and metaphysical illusions and wishful thinking, but also political moral ideologies, can profit considerably from Marx and Nietzsche. The most trenchant remarks from Karl Marx in this regard are the following, where, in an overtly patriarchal tone, speaks of men who has found only the reflection of himself in the fantastic reality of heaven, where he sought a supernatural being. Religion is the self-consciousness and self-esteem of man who has either not yet found himself or has already lost himself again. But man is not an abstract being squatting outside the world. Man is the world of men, the state, society. The state and this society produce religion, which is an inverted consciousness of the world because they are an inverted world. It is the fantastic realization of the human essence inasmuch as the human essence possesses no true reality. The struggle against religion is therefore indirect, the struggle against that world whose spiritual aroma is religion. That is, the struggle against religion is ultimately a struggle against the inverted and indeed distorted world. In this struggle against the distorted world, however, religion plays a peculiar double role. On the one hand, as already Ludwig Feuerbach quite correctly recognized, it draws attention to the distorted world and to how human beings have in fact not yet attained their true reality. On the other hand, religion itself conceals from human beings their real situation by replacing, as Marx says, true reality with fantastic reality. Religious suffering is the expression, he says, of real suffering and at the same time the protest against real suffering. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, the heart of a heartless world. It is the opium of the people. Marx insists that we not simply make do with the critique of religion. We must instead unmask human self-alienation in its unholy forms now that it has been unmasked in its holy forms. Thus, the criticism of heaven turns into the criticism of the earth, the criticism of religion into the criticism of law, and the criticism of theology into the criticism of politics. I presented you the not so well-known philosopher Rüdiger Bittner of Germany because he tries to do exactly this. Nietzsche's critique of religion similarly comes to its most imposing expression in its attack not merely on priestly deception, which distracts human beings and fixates them on a world beyond by befogging them with empty and fantastic figures and beings. For he too expands his critique of religion into a comprehensive critique of culture and morals, attacking not only the notion of the protection of the weak, as propagated by many religions, and the political, legal, and moral commitment to an ethos of equality and freedom for all. He also makes religion responsible for the success of the kind of appellative morality through which emotionalized mass culture seeks to drag down to its own base level the more refined, sensitive, and subtle members of society. Nietzsche, however, is not yet thinking about the kind of symbolic religious kitsch that alienates so many reflective persons from religion today. Just as little is he thinking about the kind of cheap, self-righteous morality that laments the situation of the world and accuses the evil others of culpability in order to divert attention from the own lethargy and impotence and from its own failures in the face of quite concrete current situations of distress. Nonetheless, any self-critical critique of religion can certainly profit from Nietzsche in becoming aware lest it similarly fall prey to such moralistic trends. Contra Nietzsche, however, theological critiques of religion must hold fast to the theological and ethical realism with their accompanying truth claims that Nietzsche perceived himself only as a distorted fashion and portrayed as blatant caricatures. Yet he does speak in certain patronizing fashion about precisely such ethical realism when diagnosing it within the framework of the ethos of love inhering within the small Jewish family of the diaspora. I give an interesting quote of Nietzsche. The reality on which Christianity could build itself was the small Jewish family of the diaspora, with its warmth and tenderness, with its readiness to help and to stand up for each other, unprecedented and perhaps uncomprehended in the whole of the Roman Empire. With its unenvious saying no deep within to everything which has the upper hand and possesses power and magnificence. To have recognized this as power, to have recognized this psychological state as communicative, seductive, infectious, for heathens too, that is the genius of Paul. Nietzsche hates Paul, but here he bows down chapeau. Nietzsche explicates how Paul recognized as power the survival strategy of the lower classes. He found before him that is the strategy of self-preservation of this kind of person. Paul lucidly articulates the survival strategy as a strategy of community self-preservation, as Nietzsche says. And he ignited this strategy of self-preservation with the principle of love. I earlier drew attention in the third lecture to the radiant power that family ethos and the religious ethos exert within the spirit of justice. Like several other eminent theologians, so did Dietrich Bonhoeffer draw self-critically from critiques of religion expressed outside theology proper. On July 8, 1944, he wrote in his letters from prison, "What I'm driving at is that God should not be smuggled in somewhere in the very last secret place that is left. One must give up the holier-than-thou ploys and not regard psychotherapy or existential philosophy as scouts preparing the way for God, not to mention, of course, metaphysical speculation." Beginning in May 1944, Bonhoeffer developed an idea that will never quite leave him, namely that of a life kept multidimensional and polyphonic. He lamented the single dimensionality and linearity characterizing the thinking of most people and remarked, I quote, "Christianity, on the other hand, puts us into many different dimensions of life at the same time. In a way, we accommodate God and the whole world within us. We weep with those who weep, and at the same time we rejoice with those who rejoice. We fear for our lives. But at the same time, we must think thoughts that are much more important to us than our lives. Life isn't pushed back into a single dimension, but is kept multidimensional, polyphonic. What a liberation is it to be able to think and to hold on to these many dimensions of life in our thoughts. One has to dislodge people from their one-track thinking." Natural theology can similarly profit today by picking up on this initiative to expand one's thinking by engaging precisely this multimodal activity of the spirit. It should similarly take seriously the philosophical and theological critiques of religion that attack not only an exaggerated focus on the beyond, but also religion itself in its role as an initiator of distorted moral, social, intellectual, and cultural developments, and in alliance with such developments. One key question for natural theology concerns the essence and nature of God. The proposal of these lectures for addressing this question can be articulated by translating a statement from the theology of Revelation into one commensurate with the conceptual world of natural theology. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. The Gospel of John attributes this statement to Jesus himself and associates it with the discourse on prayer and worship. Let us leave in abeyance for the moment the revelatory dimensions of the statement and consider seriously its initial words, namely that God is spirit. That is, let us inquire in the sense of Lord Gifford's intentions and within the framework of natural theology concerning the anthropological and ethical resonance of this divine power. And above all, let us consider as a mode of our search for truth how one might, in the light of the same spirit, expand one's understanding of human beings as made in God's image. Our previous findings are the following. Human beings are indeed made in God's image as destined seekers and practitioners of justice with an ethos of equality in a world replete with injustice and inequality. Human beings are indeed made in God's image in their destined commitment to freedom in both personal and societal life circumstances, in a world that presents countless hindrances to such freedom. And human beings are indeed made in God's image as destined seekers of truth and in the multifaceted, if fragile, efforts to attain and communicate in both thought and action an element of correctness, certitude, consensus, coherence, commensurability, and fertile and liberating knowledge. In all these considerations, human beings are, on the one hand, being gifted with earthly and transient life powers, who, on the other hand, are destined to live from within the powers of the divine spirit, and in the process not only to gain a portion of these powers, but also to communicate them to their fellow human beings and fellow creatures. It is precisely this understanding that I will summarize and invoke in the sixth and final lecture, namely, human beings as being made in the image of God through their destined commitment to peace. Thank you very much.
Can I start with, I was very relieved to hear you say that you don't dismiss bipolar or binary distinctions in the search for truth, since my PhD was on oppositional terms in language development. So I'm, but what is the, what kind of relationship would that have to the multimodal version? I mean, do you want to develop other ways in which they would relate to each other and so on?
Well, I think I throughout the lectures, I said that I highly appreciated Aristotle's metaphysics, mm-hmm. with this bipolar progress of the intellectualist search for truth. And I, of course, I'm also deeply trained in transcendental theories that always have subject, object, consciousness, self-consciousness, and so on and so on. And it was only through Whitehead that I got on a broader track. When Whitehead said, we approach the world with mathematized science, with common sense thought, bipolar, with historical modes, already more sophisticated, with religious forms, and they have difficulties to communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. And we should not try to fuse them all into one schema, but we should try to appreciate their individual procedures, encourage them to cultivate them, and yet try to bring them on specific topics together. Yeah. So this was for me a revelatory experience. And when I prepared these lectures and I turned to the young Hegel, well, I was a little reluctant to bother you with the complex philosophy of Hegel, but I thought, here you still see in a seemingly naive project, a mind operative that sees the stellar bipolar modes of Fichte and the young Schelling, with a lot of refinement, of course, but says, I want to look at a more sophisticated spirit. Then he incorporates the other modes. Yeah. And if you want clarity, it's not easy to dismiss this. Yeah. If you want to have clarity of thought, one of the comments on my lectures was, it's practically and pragmatically very convincing and even moving, but systematically it might be frustrating. Yeah? Because when you look only on cognitive approaches and clear systematic thinking, you need these forms. Yeah? And our vast communication is only possible by these reductive forms. Yeah? When I say Berlin Wall, you have an idea. When I say Napoleon, you're with me. When I say 3 times 3 is 9, you're with me. When I say a blue feathered hare, you'd say, is this guy crazy or does he want to enter strange poetry? Yeah. But we can very, very fast communicate and getting can attach our minds because we have these quick communicative forms. And here bipolar is absolutely crucial. But when you want to look at more sophisticated constellations in religion, in society, in feeling, yeah, in the human mind, not just rational, cognitive mind, then you need more forms. But then you have to host these forms, of course. And even I understand that in the academy we have to make them very dominant.
Thank you very much for a fascinating lecture again. What struck me at the very beginning when you set out sort of your working definition of truth and pointed towards accuracy, I was wondering within this multimodal approach to truth, whether something like, we might call it hermeneutical truth or let's say existential truth, something like that was maybe, I wouldn't say lost, but pushed in the background. So when we say things like, I've fallen in love, that's probably not a statement that we can describe as either accurate or inaccurate, or I dare to trust somebody. So there's sort of a performative element, if you want to phrase it in Austin's terminology. And I was wondering where that would fit into the multimodal approach to truth.
Yeah, of course, I would say that every sound philosophy proposes a schema of truth and truth claims that has its own shape and character. And so does the existential mode. Yeah? But look at Heidegger. He fought bipolar forms and tried to focus on processes. Yeah? We investigated Heidegger's development. He started with lectures, interestingly enough, on Augustine and Paul, Paul and Augustine. And then he said, well, these bipolar, he didn't say bipolar, but these forms that go with the subject-object structure and so are deeply distorted because the most elementary existential forms are driving processes. And then he describes these driving processes and inserts criteria. And then, sadly, he doesn't go with a more optimistic view of Paul, but with a more pessimistic anthropology, drawn towards death. But of course, here you have different formative, central truth claims that you have to investigate in different philosophies. And in a way, what I try to do is to put up the challenge with the intellectualist truth claim. Yeah? So it was, since my claim was from a more simple to the academic form, and you cannot praise the academic form with extracting bipolar rational truth claims. And so it was on this line. But there is more to say. I'm constantly thinking about David Ferguson's point that we should get together and work on Hegel's aesthetics. Really, that would be very, very helpful to get a concept of aesthetics that is rich, that has political and religious interests in the back, and to see what can he offer and how could we expand in other territories of aesthetics. But here again, we had to open up then other exemplary positions.
I think Professor Ferguson had a question as well.
Thank you very much once again. Michael, your references to earlier Gifford lectures, particularly Barber and Polkinghorne, were very well made. And it's interesting that in their work and in that of other scientist theologians, some of the elements of the older speculative metaphysics have started to reappear with arguments from fine-tuning and reflections and Big Bang and multiverses and so on. I mean, is there a way in which your multimodal approach to the work of the spirit can actually reintegrate some of these older features of the kind of speculative metaphysics that you're also wanting to overcome.
Yeah. Well, I like very much, again, Whitehead. I'm bothering you with a lot of Whitehead. But Whitehead differentiates between the old style metaphysics with a totalitarian approach and what he calls a metaphysics. He speaks of a metaphysics that arises when truth claims in one area of knowledge and basic concepts are tested in another area of knowledge. So he sees metaphysics as an interdisciplinary agenda. And here I'm totally with him. Yeah, I say, if this is metaphysics, no problem at all. My problem is the totalitarian. Yeah, and it's, I quoted already Beckett, are you merely interested in everything and something specific? And I have great difficulties. And I have great difficulties with theology that think when I'm totalitarian, I'm in good relation with God. This is our big, I would say, poison in theology, that we think once we have everything, the whole, and so then we have approached the divine, it does not touch the sophistication of the relation of God to our world. And that the difference between God and the world, that although the world is called good in the creation account and life-furthering, it is not paradise. It's frail, it's finite, and it's vulnerable. It is open to self-endangerment and even self-destruction. It can turn against God. And so, and the whole serious religious traditions are full of these stories. But in a way, we like always not only the nice story. You know? And so we overrule it and then make these metaphysical compliments to God and think that we are particularly faithful. But I think it is very, very important to have a realist theology. But I also think that the powers of the Spirit are very, very helpful also to get in contact with those people skeptical of faith traditions and to show that the powers of the Spirit can also be articulated in a natural theology and can also articulate it in interdisciplinary relations. And if you then say, okay, Michael, you have a metaphysics of the Spirit, I have no problems with that. But then I would say, what kind of Spirit do you mean? And for me, it's crucial that it is the Spirit of justice, truth, freedom, peace, and love. And so it's not the Spirit of everything. So yeah, it's an attempt to get a rich qualification of the powers of the divine Spirit, and under these conditions also an ennoblement of the human being that can be shaped by the Spirit, can be filled by the Spirit, and can communicate the Spirit to others.
I enjoyed listening to your lecture. Do socially marginalized groups have greater access to the truth? To put it another way, does social privilege, whether in terms of race or class or gender, does it dull the senses? Does it dull, if not outright distort, our ability to see, to discern, and to understand the world as it actually is?
Yeah. Well, I would not make an a priori statement. Yeah, the smaller, the closer to the truth. But I think yesterday I spoke about the difficulties that religions have in their confusing their power with freedom. Yeah? That they think, oh, the more powerful we get, the more we guarantee freedom. And with the help of law scholars and empirical investigations, I said, no, very often it's a majoritarian approach done here. And then you have some exemplary minorities for which you care, but on the whole, it is not a very truthful and not a very freedom-loving and also often not a very justice-concerned approach. So in this respect, a sound distrust in big powers is helpful. But again, I would say it depends what kind of minorities. you have. And you can have very chaotic and very terroristic minorities, and then, yeah. But you also have to self-critically say, are we just seeing it because we have difficulties with their value systems and with their needs and so on. And of course, there is this immense duty to avoid suffering and to help people to get out of suffering. And very often we are absolutely helpless. Yesterday, Professor Brown asked, well, and what do you make with the situation that people are deeply in the pressure of want? And in many, many cases, we have to say today, I don't know. What do you make with these almost 1 billion children that are plagued by physical need, by non-education, by exploitation, and so on and so on? And I think here we need a much more refined international communication without going imperialist. And we have to reshuffle our monetary and political capacities to a large degree. These are gigantic tasks, but as I said, I'm modestly optimistic because we see already on this planet good endeavors moving into the right direction. But it's a long way to go, and we have to fight many, many repercussions.
Brian, just behind you.
Yes, sorry, thank you. I probably a very elementary and basic question that I was sure I've not grasped the point. I mean, when one talks about bipolarity, I mean, bipolarity can be seen to have a history. I mean, if one has body and soul in Aristotle, it's different from body and soul in Descartes, say. I mean, now, when you talk about multipolarity, does that have a history? Is there a history of the multiplicity? Do some of the poles fade away and cease to be significant? Right. And are we sort of eagerly expecting another pole to begin to home in on our life? And that there has been, if you like, over the years, a changing of this multipolarity that you've mentioned. Now, absolutely. You've got me confused because you began by nodding and now you're shaking your head.
No, I couldn't agree more. We have different forms of bipolar forms. But we have this enormous domination. When you look at anthropologies, it's in a vast portion, it was always body, soul, mind, body, and so on. It was these kind of bipolar shaping of anthropologies with different philosophical traditions. Yeah. And when we had these dialogues and drew in more and more disciplines, we thought we cannot accommodate these different perspectives and different disciplines in a bipolar structure. Yeah. And for years we were plagued with this monist dualist. And we had the feeling, well, we are strangulated, we are blinded with these discourses. But again, when you say when you go into a multimolar model, you have also different schemas. And I proposed one genius, but one model. And this one model was by a blessing by this New Testament scholar, Gerd Theissen, who opened our eyes and said, look here, flesh, body, an important differentiation. And look here, you think Paul is a dualist. Yeah, he has this background dualism of finitude and eternity. But he offers many, many syntheses in his anthropology, and he offers us a spreadsheet of flesh, body, heart, soul, conscience, reason, spirit, a very nice matrix in which you can accommodate many, many interdisciplinary fields. And for us it was heartwarming to see, oh, scientists became interested, social scientists became interested, theologians became interested in this, and then we thought, okay, it's a wonderful working model. But it's a working model. Yeah. And so one day, we still have the feeling we should also include a little bit more Augustine's theories of memory, yeah, the multiple layers that Augustine brings in. So I think we, look for routes to refine our anthropological schemas. And then it's always the case, something is gained and something is lost. This is an experience of academic research. So very often you hit or you rush for new insight, and after a while you say, oh, absolutely reductionistic. Think of Girard. Everybody was intoxicated by Girard's, everything is sacrifice, everything is sacrifice. And then after a while you said, okay, I think there was some truth with this, but it's not the whole thing. And so we are very much endangered by fashion. I was for 30 years in the science and theology discourse, and it's amazing how fast the different concentrations went. We had the method phase, we had the physics phase, we had the biology phase, then we had the theology phase, and so on. And then we have now embodied anthropology, which had a strong impact on my first lectures, and so on. So we have to be very honest that we are also children of our time, children of the scientific fashions, and also the danger that fantastic new discoveries bring in the orientation into a specific direction, then all the money goes in, and all the enthusiasm goes in, and then after a while we say, something was won, but something was lost, and we have to reorient ourselves. But this is a natural way of search for truth.
Thank you very much, Professor Velkert. That was we have all benefited from the various fashions that you've been through, and it has I think enlightened the lectures very much indeed. So thank you very much for your lecture on Call to Truth.
Thank you for your questions.